we will proceed to case number 8. Take your case under advisement. Harry Alleman versus Jerry Stearns.
Good morning to this honorable body. To cut directly to the chase, the key question that may need to be decided in this case at the first juncture is whether or not the Brecht analysis of harmless error survives the AEDPA, because if it does, there's a different analysis to be conducted. It is our position that the Chapman standard should apply to Mr. Alleman's request for review, inasmuch as Brecht only applied in order to fill in the inferences from Congress's failure to enact post-Chapman proposals that would have provided a less stringent harmless error standard on collateral review. Some of the circuits are split, or there is a tacit split in the circuits between, and this court has not chimed in on whether or not Chapman should apply to a post-conviction petition or Brecht.
I understand you said this court has not chimed in.
I'm sorry. This court has not. This court has identified the bad choice of words. Identified that there is this question exists, but has not ruled on which standard would apply on a post-conviction review. And I apologize if I was flippant in my remark. I meant to say that the decision has not been made by this court. Since it is our position that the Chapman standard applies, we believe that the Court of Appeals incorrectly ruled on the federal question. At the first juncture, the state has conceded that there is constitutional error, that the comment on Mr. Alleman's failure to testify in this case was a violation of the Fifth Amendment, and therefore, through the 14th Amendment, a violation of Mr. Alleman's rights. They argued in the Court of Appeals that it was unintentional. However, the Court of Appeals and this district court decided that the arguments were intentional. They made references to Mr. Alleman being a hitman, and the court said that the negative reference to the defendant were palpable. They talked about defendant's defense counsel. And the court, the appellate court, responded that nothing in evidence presented or argument by defense counsel precipitated such an argument, and the prosecutor's argument exceeded the bounds of proper argument by negative portrayal of defense counsel. They talked about the fact that the defendant, Harry Alleman, knew whether or not or what happened with the last shot that Mr. Lowe said he eventually shot with a .45. And we know that these arguments concerning the defendant knows are directly talking about the defendant's failure to testify. Then the most egregious error, according to the appellate court, was that he was the only one in the room that didn't come on the witness stand and accept responsibility or tell you what happened. And the appellate court said that this reflected a calculated attempt to draw attention to the defendant's invocation of his right not to testify. Therefore, there is a constitutional violation here. The appellate court erred in applying federal law because the Chapman standard is that the beneficiary of a constitutional error must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the complaint of error did not contribute to the verdict. And the burden is on the state to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And the standard is whether or not it contributed, quote, to the verdict. Before the federal constitutional error can be considered harmless, the court must be able to declare a belief that it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The appellate court, however, applied the standard as whether the prosecutors at page 33 of the appellate court opinion is the dispositive question in the case was whether the prosecutor's argument resulted in substantial prejudice to the defendant and constituted a material factor in his conviction without which the jury verdict might have been different. And that standard is not the Chapman standard. They went on to say the burden, they didn't put the burden on the prosecutor. They went on to say that given the manifest weight of the evidence, the prosecutor's comments could not have been said to have altered the outcome of the trial. So it's pretty clear from the appellate court opinion that the Chapman standard wasn't applied.
Well, there are certain aspects of it that they're close to Chapman. I mean, about the the weight of the evidence really is the factor here, and whether or not that those comments contributed to the verdict.
That's correct. But the Chapman standard clearly puts the burden on the state of proving that beyond a reasonable doubt. The appellate court didn't. The Chapman standard...
Didn't the court say that there was overwhelming evidence of his guilt? That was harmless error.
The court did declare that there was overwhelming evidence of Mr. Alleman's guilt.
That was harmless error.
Yes. But the harmless error standard that they applied was a flawed harmless error standard. In fact, there is quite a similarity to the Brecht standard, because Brecht standard is whether error had a substantial and injurious effect or influence in determining the juror's verdict, which everyone agrees is a far more onerous statute for the defendant and a far easier burden for the government to prove. And that language, I would submit to the court, since the appellate court said whether it constituted a material factor and a substantial prejudice is language that more closely, in fact, in some instances almost verbatim, follows the standard enunciated in Brecht, which by no means can be applied by the appellate court, because it's the standard for this court, or it's the standard for a collateral view prior to the enactment of the AEDPA. I'm going to reserve rebuttal time to comment on the overwhelming allegation of the evidence, but I'd like to lay out what I think is the nature of the law, because it should be clear that a calculated, and these were good prosecutors, these weren't people who were doing their first or second jury trial, these were prosecutors that knew what the law was. They were warned not to do it. There was a pretrial ruling that organized crime wasn't to be part of the trial, but yet they went into various references about the First Ward Swamp and about Mr. Alleman having the personality of a hitman, and various references to meetings, and they had Mr. Cooley testify about his dealings with these First Ward individuals who were very dangerous people who might. So it was a veiled stab toward the defense, and it was an outright calling out of the defense in terms of his failure to testify. I might go further, that's to say that even if Brecht applies, which we don't believe it does, because we believe the Chapman standard rules in this case. Brecht said the holding does not foreclose the possibility that in an unusual case, a deliberate, which we all agree it was deliberate, and the appellate court said so, and especially egregious error of the trial type that is combined with a pattern of prosecutorial misconduct might so inject the proceeding as to warrant the grant of habeas relief, even if it did not substantially influence the jury verdict. So even under the Brecht standard, with the prosecutor committing reversible error of such an egregious nature, and knowing that they were committing reversible error and doing it despite warnings by the judge, may result in the reversal of the case. And I'm going to, if there's no questions right now, reserve a little rebuttal time.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. Excuse me. My name is Dominica Osterberger. I'm an assistant Illinois attorney general, and I represent the respondents in this cause. There are a couple comments I must address with respect to the initial argument by my opponent, the first of which is that in the state court and again on habeas, the petitioner alleged various errors which had occurred in closing argument, one of which was the Griffin error, which was the subject of the certificate of appealability. The other couple of errors, one pertained to the prosecutor's comment that the petitioner possessed the personality of a hitman, and the prosecutor's comment referencing defense counsel's conduct. Neither of those two arguments are the same as the Griffin error. The state court didn't treat them the same. The habeas court didn't treat them the same, and in fact, they are not the subject of the certificate of appealability in this case. So a melding of those arguments by the petitioner, I would suggest, should be met with caution by this court. The other point I wanted to mention as well is that the certificate of appealability addressed the unreasonable application of standard of 2254. The district court did not grant a certificate of appealability on the contrary to standard, which is a subject of the petitioner's argument. There are a couple of Supreme Court cases that were issued in November of last year which pertain to the contrary to standard, which I think sufficiently address his complaints with respect to the contrary to standard in any event. But I would like to point out that it is interesting that if, in fact, the state court decision was contrary to Supreme Court precedent, this court's precedent and the Supreme Court's suggestion, Early versus Packer, would support a de novo review of the claim under which Brecht, not Chapman, would apply. So if he would be successful to argue to this court that there was a contrary to standard, this court applies Brecht. Woodford versus Viciotti and Early versus Packer were two Ninth Circuit decisions that were issued by the Supreme Court in November. Basically, they address the manner in which the federal courts are to review the state court's statements about Supreme Court authority. Woodford versus Viciotti teaches us that the state court need not give a verbatim summary of the relevant Supreme Court precedent, and that the federal courts will presume that the state courts indeed know and follow the law. Early versus Packer stands for the proposition that indeed the state courts need not even cite to Supreme Court authority in order for their decisions to be consistent with the standards of 2254 and the relevant Supreme Court precedent. Those cases, combined with the outline of the analysis of the harmlessness of the error that I have provided in my brief, I think sufficiently address any argument regarding the contrary to standard. Petitioner is right that the big issue in this case would appear to be whether or not Brecht has viability under the AEDPA. Respondent, in fact, argues that Brecht remains viable. Certainly, there are a list of decisions, which I cited in my brief, suggesting both in this court and from other circuits that when de novo review is conducted, or in situations in which perhaps a contrary to finding was made, or in situations which, in fact, default was rejected and there was no Supreme Court decision to which deference must be given, that Brecht applies to the analysis. What respondent is proposing in this situation is that indeed if there is a decision made under Chapman and if the court does find that Chapman was unreasonably applied, that a petitioner should not be entitled to habeas relief unless the Brecht standard is met. That type of proposal, I would submit, preserves the concerns in Brecht that the Supreme Court had about the unwarranted grant of relief on collateral review by the use of the Chapman standard. Because, in fact, if a court finds that Chapman has been unreasonably applied, a habeas petitioner is going to be obtaining relief under Chapman. I would point out that the Supreme Court in Brecht did elect to fill what they saw to be a perceived gap in what the harmless error analysis would be with habeas. There's still a gap in the statute. It is silent as to what applicable standards would apply or what type of harmless error analysis should be done. But certainly Congress was aware of Brecht and aware of the prior precedence of the Supreme Court limiting the availability of habeas relief in the context of harmless error review. The Supreme Court in Brecht noted that habeas relief is available only to those persons who are grievously wronged. And that comity and finality concerns about the state court decisions would seem to be contrary to the application of Chapman on collateral review. They basically suggested that one Chapman analysis is enough, and that is what the federal courts viewed that the state courts had done. Therefore, the Brecht analysis would apply. There are several cases that I cited in our brief with respect to that, the most significant of which is the Sixth Circuit's decision in Nevers, in which they stated that there is a concern as to how to determine whether a state court unreasonably applied to Chapman. What they did in that case was to say, they're going to consider the unreasonable application under 2254, but how do you do it? And they said, well, we're going to use Brecht, because if a petitioner is going to win under Brecht, then surely Chapman was unreasonably applied. That is tantamount to the analysis that I have suggested that this court should conduct. The same category of petitioners who would get relief under the proposal that I have submitted to this court obtain relief under Nevers. It does preserve the concerns in Brecht about the availability of relief with respect to the high standard of Chapman. The First Circuit in SANA, also cited in my brief, also suggested that if in fact 2254 would entitle a defendant for relief on its plain face of it, that a harmless error analysis under the Brecht standard should indeed apply as well. And I would point out that this court, in an en banc decision in Gardner, addressed a state court decision with respect to a continuance. The argument there had been that a continuance was necessary because a witness was going to testify to certain information, and the state court denied the continuance on the ground that the proposed information was not material to the defendant's guilt. And this court suggested that a Brecht analysis would indeed be relevant to the consideration of whether or not that state court decision was, in fact, an unreasonable application of federal law. Given all of these factors, I would submit that Brecht indeed remains viable, certainly upon de novo applications, and in a situation in which there is an unreasonable application, Brecht has to be addressed and asked before habeas relief can be granted to a petitioner. I would be happy to answer any questions that this court might have about any of the issues here. Thank you.
I have 2 minutes. I'll try to go as quickly as possible. There is de novo review, and Congress didn't know about the Brecht standard and didn't choose to incorporate it. They chose to incorporate the language that they did incorporate, which gives the Chapman standard. The fact is, we have a case here where there's two witnesses that testify, and this is supposedly overwhelming evidence. But the two witnesses contradict each other on every salient point. Mr. Almeida, lifetime criminal sitting in a federal Bastille, attempts suicide to get out of jail. When he can't do that, he calls the government. Instead of 30 years, he gets 10 years. He testifies in 1977 that he saw an individual on the street, never said he saw a dog. The individual on the street says he had a dog. The individual on the street said he walked the dog by 10 minutes before the shooting, and the shooting actually occurred an hour later. There was a difference about the cars. There was a fact that Mr. Lowe first testified that Mr. Allman got out and put a .45 slug into someone's head, which belied the physical evidence, which belied everything that happened on the street. Witnesses testified that Mr. Lowe wasn't even on the street. There was no one on the street that evening. Two witnesses testified to that. That they didn't see anybody else outside the car. They didn't see Mr. Lowe at the time of the shooting. And those were witnesses that saw the shooting occur. So whether or not the evidence is overwhelming is based upon the attack of defense counsel, the pretrial articles that indicated he was a hitman, the fact that the jury was talking about the fact that they might be dead by the end of the trial, the fact that this organized crime evidence was admitted in the case, because what you had at its purest essence was two witnesses who testified completely contradictory.
You want to argue the law or the facts?
Right now I'm arguing the facts because Your Honor brought up the fact that whether or not there was...
It isn't the court that determines the facts.
Well, I think it...
That's what's determined in the trial court.
I understand, but Your Honor brought up the fact that there was a statement by the Court of Appeals that there was overwhelming evidence.
That's exactly what I brought up.
And now the standard that they used to determine that overwhelming evidence was misapplied. It's Chapman versus Brecht. If it's Brecht, that the analysis is different. This court has not said that Brecht applies. Congress has not said that Brecht applies. They didn't incorporate that language into the AEDPA when it was written. They incorporated language that it was contrary to federal law. Federal law is completely Chapman because Chapman says what the standard is for a federal determination as to whether or not what happens when there's a constitutional violation. The evidence becomes relevant in this court.
You have half a minute. Your light is beyond the
okay.
time.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead. Continue.
Oh. The evidence was only relevant, I was going to say, to determine whether or not there's overwhelming evidence. And this court may have to look at that evidence and may have to look at the nature of the evidence to determine under whatever standard we decide, since the standard was misapplied in the appellate court, as I told you, what their statement was concerning what the standard of review was. And
thank
I know
you,
I've overstayed my welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for your help, too, counsel. We will proceed.